We'll hear arguments first this morning in Penn Central Transportation Company against the City of New York. Mr. Gribben, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, perhaps I should be intimidated, legally if not physically, by the sheer number of governments and organizations on the other side of the question presented on this appeal. There have come to the support of the Appalachee, the greatest city in the world, three other major cities, the nation's two largest states.
When you say greatest, are you referring by population?
Yeah. I would prefer to encompass all aspects.
Or weather?
Pardon me?
Or weather?
I'll still stay with greatest.
Or total debt.
Total tax?
Debt.
It may qualify on all those scores.
Mr. Gribben, which city are you referring to?
not Chicago. In addition, 20 civic organizations, all highly respected. And finally, the United States has had sufficient interest not only to file a brief but to participate in argument. But I am not so intimidated, because the position that I put to you here on behalf of Penn Central rests on the Bill of Rights, that great charter of liberties. It serves as a protection against all government, not just venal government, but even the best-intentioned government. In addition, I would suggest that the unusual display of public interest here serves to emphasize a principal element in Penn Central's case. That is the enormous public benefit, which it is claimed will be brought about by the governmental action that we challenge. As a result of actions taken by the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission pursuant to the city's landmarks law, Penn Central has been prohibited from constructing an office building over the Grand Central Terminal. Now, that prohibition has been imposed by the city not because such a building would be unsafe or uneconomic or in violation of zoning regulations, but solely to assure that all who live in New York and all who visit New York will have an unimpeded view and unrestricted enjoyment of the terminal, a structure which the Commission found to be a magnificent example of French Beaux-Arts architecture. After the terminal had been designated as a landmark by a commission of 11 private citizens reporting generally to the Board of Estimate, three separate efforts were made under the guidance of an internationally known architect, Marcel Breuer, to persuade the Commission, in accordance with its procedures, that an office building could be constructed without impairing the integrity of the terminal. All three were rejected, and it is now common ground among the parties that Penn Central stands effectively precluded from constructing a building over the terminal. The record discloses that in return for the use of the air rights over the terminal, Penn Central would receive from a developer who would bear all the risks of constructing the building $1 million a year during construction, and thereafter a minimum of $3 million a year, escalating as rental collections increased.
Is there in the record anywhere a picture or a drawing, an architect's drawing or a sketch of what this building would look like?
There is, Your Honor. At record 2001, it's in volume 4.
Not in the appendix.
Not in the appendix, no, Your Honor. It's in the record came up from the lower court.
Thank you.
Which is lodged, I understand. I say, therefore, that there can be no doubt that the city's action has deprived Penn Central of something of value. While the city recognizes that Penn Central has been denied the right to construct an office building, which it's entitled to do otherwise under applicable zoning regulations, the city refuses to acknowledge that air rights constitute a form of property. It even suggests that the use of the term is something of a semantic trick. Such rights, however, have been widely used, sold, utilized for 50 years, and the Court of Appeals didn't hesitate to describe the controversy as one involving air rights to the terminal. Now, I do not urge that the decision here should turn on whether Penn Central's loss is characterized as a property right or as a use. As the Solicitor General correctly puts it, it is the substance of the government action that controls rather than the labels that are attached to it.
You don't question the right of the City of New York to take this entire property, do you?
No, Your Honor. The issue raised here is not, as some of the briefs seem to suggest, whether the City of New York may validly preclude Penn Central from constructing a building. 25 years ago in Berman and Parker, this Court, in a unanimous opinion, proclaimed for all that it's just as appropriate for government action to look to things that beautify and enhance the quality of life as it is to do away with things that are unsanitary. But the issue here, simply stated, is who's going to bear the loss of the burden that's occasioned by this substantial public benefit.
Is there any doubt about how this case would have come out before the enactment of the 14th Amendment?
I would think the same considerations are present now, Mr. Justice Rehnquist.
What would you have relied on before the enactment of the 14th Amendment?
I would think the Fifth Amendment.
But Barron against Baltimore said the Fifth Amendment applied.
There might have to be a little rewriting of some of the decisions there, but looking at what the Fifth Amendment has been held to do since then, I would have thought that the Fifth Amendment would provide assurance here. If it were to come up today without the 14th Amendment, it's very difficult to imagine those circumstances.
In today's legal climate, I mean, you don't have to be that vague. Hasn't a case from this court held that the 14th Amendment does incorporate the Fifth Amendment?
Yes, Your Honor.
The taking clause?
Right. And I say I don't really think you need I haven't dealt with that and wouldn't propose to do it on that basis. Now, I would propose to address the issue that I have stated here, first by examining the central premise of the different justifications that have been advanced, first by the Court of Appeals and second by the city and its friends, for imposing the full cost on Penn Central. And that premise is that where the government acts in a regulatory capacity rather than through the exercise of eminent domain, there's no need to inquire whether there's been a compensable taking. I shall next show that the decisions of this Court interpreting the taking clause of the Fifth Amendment, particularly those emphasizing its high content of fairness, support the conclusion that the prohibitions imposed here do constitute a taking for which compensation is constitutionally required.
Now, you talk about the full cost. The full cost of what?
Of not being able to build an office building. The loss that is suffered by being prevented from developing an office building over the terminal.
Now, it's been held in a case, Hudson, I think it was, that a municipality could limit the height of all buildings within its borders, hasn't it?
Your Honor, I think that's true. The height limitation cases, I don't believe, have application here because
well, no,
this
why not?
Is
why
very...
Isn't that, why isn't that a taking?
The Pan Am building
Excuse me.
Is not the shortest building.
Is not?
It's not the shortest building.
No, Your Honor, it's there.
It's right next to it.
Right next to it.
Why isn't
Because it's selective, Your Honor. It doesn't say...
No, the taking is just the same, selective or non-selective, isn't it?
No, I think under the zoning cases...
It might be discrimination, but there's, from the point of view of the taking, it's just exactly the same. If you limit every building in the municipality to no more than 15 stories.
I think the decisions indicate that the zoning, which is comprehensive and applies substantially equally to all people affected within the area, can be tolerated as a non-compensable taking on the ground that the benefits and the burdens are reasonably dispersed,
but
not
from
precisely.
The point of view of the property owner, the taking is precisely the same, is it not?
That's right. But I think the fact that other people are similarly burdened and presumably similarly benefited by the height limitation has served to justify the zoning cases, and I don't think it can serve here to justify this selective, highly particularized taking.
Well, I can understand your argument based upon discrimination of some kind, but if it has been established, as I think you concede it has, that a municipal government can limit the height of every building within its borders, why isn't it, from the point of view of the property owner, just as much a taking in that case as it is in your case?
Well, I think in many instances there's just as much of a taking on the property owner when something is done by regulation as by eminent domain. But in the regulation cases, where you're removing offensive uses, or where in the zoning cases you are acting broadly to take care of the entire community and distributing the burdens and the bends and the benefits, it has been held not to be a taking. Now, in terms of English language, yes. In terms of the Constitution, I think it's just that difference.
Well, isn't the point that you, in the situation you're referring to, as distinguished from that as Mr. Justice Stewart is referring to, they're taking some but not all, or they're taking one but not all the other?
That's right. Selective. It is a height limitation for one building. All of its neighbors, including Pan Am and all the others, can go much, much higher.
Well, this I fully understand, but I just still have difficulty understanding it. Why it isn't as much a taking in one case as in the other.
Well,
now,
maybe
quite apart from any argument based upon discrimination or irrationality or anything else.
Well, all I can say is that the zoning cases have viewed it as being a permissible use of the regulatory power when it is done in a way
You don't try to justify it rationally. You just say that that's authority, not
right.
reason.
I think that's about what... I don't know that it isn't rational to say when all people within the area are similarly treated, nobody can have a residence or nobody can have industry. That is a permissible use of the governmental
power. Several wrongs don't make a right. They make just several wrongs, don't they?
Yes, I think that's right. But that depends on whether it's wrong to start with. The Constitution doesn't prevent the government from effecting necessary regulations, and every action of government has to have some kind of an adverse effect on somebody. And the question is where the line is going to be drawn on that adverse effect.
Well, is there a matter of equal protection here somewhere?
Well, Your Honor, we do not argue an equal protection. I think it is a solid case for a taking. The equal protection cases don't give a great deal of comfort. It perhaps is warranted for the government to pick out an historic site and say this should be preserved. We don't think it has to pick out every site, and you can't argue as to which site is historic. And I think it is sufficient that we simply argue that when they do that, they pay for what they take for the public benefit.
And the theory behind I'll avoid the use of the word taking. The limitation, because it is an historic place and an historic monument, is that that's for the benefit of everyone.
Of everybody.
Yes. And so you say if it's for the benefit of everybody, everybody should pay for it.
Everybody should pay for it. And there is no balancing of benefits and burdens as there is in the zoning cases, whereas Mr. Justice and I have just been discussing, the court has held that they are not within the taking provision.
Well, isn't part of the reasoning for the generalized use of the height regulation the notion that all of the buildings that are subject to that height regulation also derive some benefit from it, in that their competitors, so to speak, can't build above them, and that each of them will have a good view from the top floor and that
Precisely,
sort of thing?
Precisely, Your Honor. It's thought there is a fair distribution not only of costs but of burdens, and that therefore there is no taking.
Now, and the benefits, as my brother Rehnquist implies in his question, the theory is, I think, that benefits are accorded to everybody in terms of light and air and
yes.
so on.
Which is not true here.
Right.
We're solely burdened and unbenefited. Everybody else, not just the buildings, but the visitors and the people of Dewitt are the ones that get the whole benefit out of it. Now, the first point I wanted to make is that however the government acts, whether by eminent domain or purporting to act by government regulation, there must be an inquiry into whether there's a compensable taking. Now, the Court of Appeals brushed that over. They simply recited, this is government regulation, and therefore there need be no kind of an inquiry into taking. Those who support the Court's action take the same view, that automatically, once you can say this is regulatory action, then there is no reason or there is no occasion to look to see whether there's compensation. Now, that is the premise that underlies both the Court of Appeals' opinion and also the position submitted by the city here, and I think it isn't supported by the Constitution, by the Fifth Amendment itself, or by the cases. The Fifth Amendment doesn't, by its terms, apply only to cases of eminent domain. It applies broadly, and cases in this course have held that whatever governmental power is exercised, police power, commerce power, if there is a taking, you look to see whether the Fifth Amendment comes into play. I suppose Berman v. Parker, which I mentioned earlier, stands for the proposition that the right of government to bring about changes designed, as they put it, to enhance the quality of life, all comes within the police power, whether it is done under eminent domain or whether it is done through the exercise of regulatory action. And in most of the cases where there is a problem as to a taking, there hasn't been an exercise of eminent domain. It's government regulation which has operated in a way which may constitute a taking, even though the exercise of eminent domain has not been tried. Now, it's claimed here that the Goldblatt decision of this court establishes a different rule, a rule that says you don't look, in the case of regulation, to what has been taken. You look, rather, to what's left over. Now, that decision does contain some language with respect to the uses left to the property owner, but I do not believe it establishes anything like the proposition claimed here. The challenge regulation there prevented a sand and gravel company from continuing its operations on property that was originally rural but had become surrounded by the city of Hempstead. Now, far from saying, as is urged here, that valid regulatory action cannot result in a compensable taking, the court speaking through Mr. Justice Clark, acknowledged at the outset the basic principle on which we rest our case, saying governmental action in the form of regulation can be so onerous as to constitute a taking which constitutionally requires compensation. It then found that there had been no diminution in the value of the property involved, and therefore there wasn't any taking. It went on to find, despite the owner's claim that sand and gravel operations were utterly benign and unlike the other things that had been barred by the exercise of government regulation, the court overruled them and said on safety grounds this would be upheld as a valid exercise of the police power. But it didn't say that as a substitute for a finding that a taking had not taken place. And I submit that that is the initial inquiry, whether a taking has taken place. And that is the inquiry that the Court of Appeals did not make and which those supporting the city would not make. Those words, that constitutional guarantee that property shall not be taken without compensation, incorporate an exceedingly complex constitutional concept. And although it's been with us since the beginning of the Republic, nothing approaching an all-purpose principle has been articulated from which one can discern the specific application of the concept. And this Court has time and again turned down the opportunity to enunciate any such principle. A scholar in the area recently wrote that judicial efforts to chart a usable test for determining when police power measures impose constitutionally compensable losses have on the whole been notably unsuccessful. With some exceptions, the decisional law is largely characterized by confusing and incompatible results, often explained in conclusionary terminology, circular reasoning, and empty rhetoric. Now, those are the scholar's words, not mine. But I hasten to say that I have no all-purpose test to offer the court, and I acknowledge more than the normal humility with which one must approach such constitutional questions. I do put to you, however, that a review of the taking cases does disclose two guidelines that may usefully be applied here in determining whether the city's action constitutes a compensable taking. When regulatory action is directed towards the elimination of offensive uses or conditions, it has been held in many cases that the resulting loss to the property owner is non-compensable because it is one that he may be properly called upon to bear for the public good. Such cases began, as you all know, with the elimination of nuisances, common nuisances, and then went on to encompass other properties and uses which, though not nuisances, were offensive to the general tenor of the community, such as breweries and billiard halls and livery stables. Now, the construction of a multi-story office building in Midtown Manhattan, which Penn Central is prohibited from doing, is not only permitted by the zoning laws, but it's actually encouraged as an efficient use of valuable land. And I submit, therefore, that the principal justification for tolerating some non-compensable diminution in property value as a result of government regulation lends no support to the city's action here.
Would you be making the same argument here if all you wanted to do was to replace the building with one of the same height? It's just that you the building was inefficient and you just wanted to build a new building, but you're quite willing to not go up with it, just at the same height. And the city said, no, we want you to keep the old building.
I think if it caused us loss, and from what you say it would cause us loss, we would be making the same argument. Any action that we're forced to take or kept from taking that causes us a monetary loss is compensable.
So it just isn't that some airspace is being taken.
Well, in this particular case...
That
isn't the whole thing, no. I think it is any governmental action of this landmark designation nature.
And this would be... So it just would be... This would be a taking because... The city would be keeping you from making more profit than you could by using the same kind of same size building.
Well, I would put it because they are taking a part of our property. They're taking a part of our property right.
You'd make the argument even if it were conceded, which I'm sure it isn't, even if it were conceded that the old building was profitable in the sense that you weren't losing any money on it.
Yes, Your Honor. If there were a
cost,
if
you could double what a decent accounting would show you could make by using the building, you would say they're taking part of your property.
I think that's a fair statement. Yes.
And that's your fundamental argument. No,
but it's based on the notion that the reason they're doing it is to benefit the general public, and if we can show any loss under the taking cases, whether it is an expectancy of profit here or whether it's a demolition, then it should be compensable. When they take 3 acres out of 100 acres of land, they don't look and say, well, you can do pretty well on the other 97 acres. They say they've taken 3 acres and we'll give you the value of it. And that, I submit, is precisely what we're faced with here.
Mr. Griffin, back in 1911, one plan considered was a 20-story tower on the property, wasn't there?
Yes, over the terminal?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has anything along that line been suggested to the Commission here at this point?
No, Your Honor. Nothing that small has been suggested, simply because it would be an inefficient utilization of land. There are no other buildings really in that area that have been built in recent days that would build only that much floor space. And that's the problem in this highly prized portion of the city, to get as much floor space as is consistent with other needs. So the answer is no, it has not been. Although I must say, there isn't any suggestion in the action taken by the Landmarks Commission that even that would satisfy. Nothing is going to satisfy, because they want the air to roam freely over Grand Central Station. So
has there been a suggestion to the contrary, that the other way?
That 20 stories would not do?
Yes.
No, there has not been, to my knowledge. But there has been no resilience in the Landmarks Commission with 3 efforts to do this under guidance of noted people. And the answer comes back, no, no, no. Every indication that what is wanted is the preservation of Penn Central in its pristine state. But that's the only way that the people of New York and its visitors are going to continue to enjoy this architectural monument.
Suppose 20 years ago, 30 years ago, before we were as much concerned with the past as we are now and preserving the past, you had built over the Penn Central station without using any part of the station, but just built over it to a 60, 70-story hotel. And the commission now decided that was marring the appearance, the aesthetic value of this landmark, and they wanted you to tear it down. I suppose not much doubt that you would expect compensation.
Correct.
For that.
They could condemn it, or they could regulate it, and we would be entitled to compensation. But I think the power of the city is there, and that's one of the things to be concerned about, that it is there.
And are you suggesting that there's no difference in the taking aspect today, in the present situation, than in the one I hypothesized?
Well, I don't think there should be, and I don't perceive a difference. I would have thought that would be a taking
in terms of
20 years
First
ago.
Amendment principles.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that would have clearly have been a taking 20 years ago, as well as today.
Mr. Griffin, not to bomb this case, but how did Penn Central or Grand Central, how did they get that piece of land right in the middle Park Avenue?
Well, there's a long history to it. They bargained. They were pioneers.
Did they steal it? Did they steal it fair and square?
They didn't steal it fair and square. They acquired it over a long period of time. And indeed, that building there has done a great deal for the middle of New York. And which came first is pretty hard to say.
It sure does. When you drive, and you have to go all the way around it.
Well, that's what the city wants to maintain. They acquired it over many years from predecessor railroads, largely. And it is the Grand Central Terminal now that we're talking about, and not Penn Central. That is gone. Now, I submit that the most frequently applied consideration in determining when government regulation has resulted in a compensable taking is simply stated one of fairness. As this Court observed in the Corus case, there's a strong element of ethics in the constitutional requirement that private property not be taken without compensation. And time and again, decisions of this Court have reiterated that the overriding purpose of the Fifth Amendment guarantee is to assure fairness in the impact of government upon the owners of private property. Back in 1893, Mr. Justice Brewer, speaking for the Court, said, "The Fifth Amendment prevents the public from loading upon one individual more than his just share of the burdens of government." 40 years later, Mr. Justice Brandeis, speaking for the Court, "Particular individuals may not be singled out to bear the cost of advancing the public convenience." In 1960, the Court said the Fifth Amendment is designed to bar the government from forcing some people alone to bear public burdens, which, in all fairness and justice, should be borne by the public as a whole. And just a few years ago, in a decision by Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I think the essence of these declarations was captured in a statement that the Fifth Amendment derives as much content from basic equitable principles of fairness as it does from technical concepts of property law. Now, these two taking guidelines that I have suggested would appear to be opposite sides of the same coin. Where you are eliminating a use or a condition which is imposing a burden on other people, it's fair to permit the person who is charging that to take some expense, to take some burden, in order to eliminate the burden that is on the rest of the people. On the other hand, where the government sets out to secure an improvement or a benefit for all society, performing what has been called its entrepreneurial or its resource acquisition function, basic considerations of fairness dictate that a disproportionate share of the cost of securing that benefit not be borne or loaded on a single individual. Now, significantly, neither the Court of Appeals nor the city and its supporting friends have anything to say about this fairness concept, which has to be the lifeblood of the Fifth Amendment. Nothing they could say would alter the fact that the full burden of the city's action in freezing the terminal falls exclusively on Penn Central, and it is being called upon to bear a public burden which, in all fairness and justice, should be borne by the public as a whole in order to obtain the full and unimpeded enjoyment of the terminal. I turn now to the justification that the Court of Appeals found for allowing the full cost of the terminal preservation to be borne by Penn Central. It made no inquiry into taking and simply looked to see whether Penn Central had established that it would be impossible, and that's the word of the court, for it to earn a reasonable return on the terminal without utilizing the air rights. It is our contention, of course, that whatever the remaining value of the terminal, we are entitled to compensation for that part that has been taken. But even if the remaining value of the terminal is to be given the critical significance that's been accorded it by the court, that value was erroneously ascertained. In applying what it acknowledged to be a special rule for landmark statutes, the court divided the value of property into two separate ingredients, that contributed by private efforts and that contributed by the efforts of organized society as a whole. Then, without attempting to ascertain how much of the terminal's value had been contributed by private or society efforts, it concluded that Penn Central was not entitled to any compensation because it had failed to establish that there was no possibility that it could not earn a reasonable return on the remaining and also unascertained privately contributed value of the terminal.
As I read over the briefs filed by your brothers and sisters on the other side, it was my impression that none of them really tried to defend the basic reasoning of that part of the reasoning of the Court of Appeals.
I believe that's a fair statement, Mr. Justice Stewart. That's the way I read those briefs. They all back away to some degree and come forward with a further explanation of why the decision should go against Penn Central.
Well, that really, the Court of Appeals really is a statement of Henry George's single tax.
Very close.
Yeah, but I submit it is not a statement of sound constitutional law, as many of Henry James' things were not necessarily sound
George.
Or Doc George, I'm sorry.
Henry George.
James would be different. The court then went on, in addition to these two ingredients of value, to impute a great deal of income, which it did not quantify, to the terminal from other buildings in the area. And then, as if to put its position beyond all argument, the court observed that the terminal may be capable of producing a reasonable return for its owners, even if it can never operate at a profit. Now, I submit that under no circumstances can the court's view of whether Penn Central is able to earn a reasonable return on this property absent the development rights be accepted. I think its effort to divide property into these two segments, it really has no support in the authorities, and it's a principle that cannot be limited. It can't be limited to the terminal or to landmarks. It applies to all property. It applies to a residence. It applies to a farm, to an office building. They are all valuable or not valuable, depending upon their location, depending upon social services, protection, and amenities. Now, if this approach were adopted, the government would be free to appropriate any property by giving only a pittance of what that property is worth on the open market. The error in the court's opinion is perhaps further disclosed in the passage near the end, where it refers to the city's financial distress, and then says that in times of easy affluence, preservation of landmarks through eminent domain might be desirable or even required. Surely, however, no constitutional guarantee, particularly one based on the Fifth Amendment, should be granted or denied depending upon the government's fiscal condition.
Mr. Gribben, down near the White House across the street from the Hay Adams Hotel is an historic church. I suppose it goes back well over 100 years, does it not?
St. John's?
St. John's Church. I would assume, and I think you would assume with me, that the land underlying that church is a very valuable piece of property for an office building or another hotel or whatnot. If that were taken, if the church, which presumably has fee title to that property, began negotiations for the sale of it to Hilton Hotel Corporation or someone to build a hotel there, and some effort was made by the Congress to preserve it, what would that be a taking in your view if they said, no, you cannot tear that down and build a Hilton Hotel, you can only, you can't do anything with it. You've got to keep it the way it is.
I think it would, Your Honor. As you put the case, it seems to me it would be a taking, and the church would be entitled to compensation on the value of that land and building.
Now, what if then in that process, that inquiry, it developed that that church was the result of many, many contributions by people, that the church corporation as such didn't ever put a single dollar into it, that it was all gift money. Would that make any difference?
I don't think it would. I think whoever held the title at that point would be entitled to the compensation.
And they'd be entitled to get the compensation for the highest and best use of that land as of today?
Well, that's a phrase that has been bandied in the cases, and I'm not too sure of the meaning. I think they'd be willing to get what that property is worth, what the Hilton Hotel would pay for them.
Is that,
which may be
presumably
the highest,
at the moment, the highest and best use would be a hotel site.
If that is permitted by the generally applicable zoning laws. Mm-hmm. And I take it it would be because there's a hotel across the street.
And they would, of course, be limited to the height limits
whatever they are,
D.C., 800
but
feet or something.
The same as everybody else is limited. But what an owner has invested in a piece of property is really quite immaterial to what he gets when that property is taken. He may have an enormous investment, but he's not going to get it back if the property isn't worth that. Or he may have a fully depreciated investment so that it's net zero. And yet it's the value. It's the loss to that owner. It isn't really what is acquired or what the investment was, but the loss to the owner, which is determinative. As we discussed earlier here in my colloquy with Mr. Justice Stewart, the city and its friends back away from the Court of Appeals rationale and attempt to salvage this statute as being simply a form of land use regulation or zoning. In the first place, there isn't any general principle that all land use regulation or all zoning is permissible and does not constitute a taking. This court made that clear in the leading case of Euclid against Ambler. The basis on which many zoning laws have been upheld is that they represent a comprehensive regulatory program. And this court has used the term comprehensive in a number of recent decisions. It has not been defined, but I take it that if comprehensive means anything, it means something close to the opposite of selective or highly particularized. And that is the vice of this landmark law. It isn't zoning. It doesn't purport to be zoning. It is on top of the zoning laws. There are vast, pervasive zoning laws in the city of New York, and this sits on top of them, superimposed, and it permits highly selective and particularized actions. The designation, for example, of the public library or of the Brooklyn Bridge or the Statue of Liberty as historic landmarks doesn't mean anything. The designation of a fine old home as an historic landmark may simply give the owner the satisfaction of putting a brass plaque on the door to that effect. The recent designation of the Radio City Music Hall interior as a landmark was followed very quickly by efforts by the state and the city to put up about $2 million to keep the show going for another year. But it is the unpredictable nature and the highly selective nature of what not only has been done, but indeed what the law contemplates. And that is why the Court of Appeals looked at this as zoning and said, no, sir, it cannot be zoning. This really resembles discriminatory zoning, which has been condemned, and it declined to condemn it because it was historical.
Mr. Griffin, may I interrupt with a question? When does the taking place take place? Supposing with respect to the Chief Justice's example of the church, which say it had no negotiations with Hilton, but the Congress decided that they would designate it as a historic landmark today. They had no deal on the fire or anything like that. Would there be a taking then, or would it only take place when they could show they had a better offer?
I would think it would take place at the former time.
And then why do you say the putting a plaque on the door of a home is just a ceremonial act? Why wouldn't that also be a taking?
I don't think it imposes any burden or loss. Indeed, it's a net gain for the owner. He doesn't have to do anything.
But
he's permitted to put it on.
Isn't he equally forbidden to tear down the house and sell it for something
else?
That
depends upon what he can later work out with the Landmarks Commission, whether he can have additions to it which will not impair the integrity of the house, just as Penn Central attempted to do things that wouldn't impair the terminal. The mere designation is just the start of the game.
Oh, I see.
Okay, and you're assuming with the house that it's in a single-family occupancy zone.
Yes.
And so it could never be anything more than basically
it's
what it is.
It's not burdened. It's not burdened the way Penn Central has been burdened.
Which is in a commercial zone.
In a commercial zone where it is precluded from doing what is permitted
by
under the zoning law.
A commercial zone.
That's right. Under any zoning laws, the people who are affected do have to deal with some restrictions. But those restrictions are uniformly applied, and the affected person can move around. It can develop. It can do things within those zoning restrictions. Penn Central has no such freedom. The terminal has, in effect, been selected out and frozen in place. And I submit that the Landmarks Law has thus operated as a compensable taking of its property rights, which require compensation.
Mr. Justice Berger, may it please the Court. The appellant's argument has proceeded from the approach that the only method to regulate public private property is by through the principles of eminent domain.
I don't think so. I think counsel very clearly conceded the complete validity of all the zoning legislation in New York City, at least for the purposes of this case.
Well, let me just establish the perimeter of the appellant's argument.
Well, you don't contend this is a zoning case, do you?
No. What we contend is this is another type of land use regulation with the very same tests enunciated by this court for all other land use cases where it was applied here.
As applied to one particular unit?
No, we are not. Now, this is the nub of the case. The appellant has proceeded with the assumption that Grand Central Terminal has been singled out, that analysis might be correct if there had never been a landmarks preservation law. And in response to an announcement by Penn Central that they were going to build a building on top of Grand Central Terminal, that the public reacted to it and passed a law that distinctively impacted on Penn Central.
That is the case we have now?
That is not what is before the court.
Well, how would it be different to constitutional?
In this particular case, we have a comprehensive land use plan which sets out in advance the criteria for determining whether or not a building is architecturally or historically significant. The intention of the plan is to preserve all historical buildings, whether by accident they're a part of a historic district or they're single and outside the district.
What if the five boroughs got together and said together that there just isn't much open space in the five boroughs? And so we're going to preserve all the open space just as it is, even though it may be in private ownership. Do you think that would be constitutional?
It would depend on the strength. You're saying without any...
No, finding that there's a...
The answer would be no, because the individual who is affected by the regulation would not be getting any return on his property, nor would he be permitted to use his property for any purpose.
Well, so supposing he was allowed to use it as open space, he could graze cattle there or have dairy trucks?
No, because that would not be economically productive. And we don't contend that if the appellant in this case had been able to establish that his property as restricted was not economically viable, that he would not be entitled to relief.
Supposing, Brother Rehnquist's example, he was permitted to to put a fence around it, and if people wanted to come and sit in the sunshine, they could pay a little fee, and he raised enough to pay his taxes and maybe a 1% profit.
No, that would be insufficient. The test is whether or not the property as restricted is economically viable. It's the same test that's been applied by this court in other land use regulations.
And it wouldn't be enough to say for the landowner to say, well, it may be, I may be able to make a profit here the way it is, but I could make two or three times as much if you permitted another use.
That is correct. That the test is not whether or not he can receive the highest and best use. There has been no taking in this case. The appellant has not had any out-of-pocket expense incurred. What he has lost is the potential to develop his property to the highest and best use.
Don't you think that's a valuable right?
Yes. But it must be balanced against the validity of the land use regulation.
Which is for the benefit of...
The entire community of which the appellant is a part.
But you don't think the entire community should bear the cost of the benefits for the entire community?
No. What I am saying is that the entire community should pay the appellant if the restriction denies him the right to earn a reasonable rate of return. The problem here is that everybody is trying to analogize this case to zoning. But it is a different type of land use regulation, the promotion of which has the same effect on the community as does zoning, and that is to make the community more attractive.
When you say reasonable rate of return, you sound like it's a public utility.
No, it's traditionally been a... We have not quantified it, except to the extent that it's been suggested that 6% would be reasonable. But we never got to the point in this litigation because there was a total failure of proof. The appellant was unable to show that he could not make a profit. That is precisely why we had the trial in the state court.
But suppose instead of this being owned by the Penn Central, this had been a private residence of great historic importance, Commodore Vanderbilt's house or some such thing,
right,
and the Landmark Commission wanted to take it.
What
kind of a return do you have on a private residence to use the measurement that you're suggesting here?
Well, in that case, the question was whether or not our designation would interfere with the existing use. To the extent that the owner wanted to convert the private residence to a commercial residence, then he would be entitled to show whether the property was economically viable.
Well, how about my hypothetical question to Mr. Gibbon on St. John's Church over by the White House, by Lafayette Park? Do you think St. John's Church could get the reasonable market value of the land less the cost of demolition?
No. If the designation did not interfere with the use of the church as a church, since it's a nonprofit association, it would be our position that that church could be maintained as part of an overall scheme to preserve landmarks.
Even if they wanted to do what the National Presbyterian Church did, to sell its downtown church for a very large office building site and move out to the outskirts where the parishioners could get to church more readily.
Well, if there was a justification, then they could apply to the Landmarks Commission, and that would be a condition that would be considered by the commission.
In fixing value?
Yes. That isn't involved in this particular case.
Well, when you get to, is the Landmark Commission qualified to deal with due process?
No. The Landmark Commission
is... Well, aren't you giving it that business?
No. What I am saying is that they have set up a procedure to determine which properties are historically significant. They have set up criteria...
Well, you say it's not a zoning commission.
It is like a zoning commission to the extent that it's
an expert...
But a
minute ago you said, oh, no, you...
No, 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 I wasn't able to finish.
You weren't going to get in no zoning business. I thought that's what you said.
What I said...
Well, now you're going in zoning?
No. What I'm saying that in both zoning and landmarks, you have expert commissions charged with the responsibility of developing a comprehensive land use scheme. The purpose of the scheme is to benefit the community. What I am saying is that with respect to...
And I assume that commission knows how to operate a railroad terminal?
No. The commission determines whether the railroad terminal fits under the criteria before it. That is, whether it's architecturally and historically significant. Once it is designated, if it imposes a hardship, that is, if it denies the appellant a reasonable rate of return or makes the property
economic... Who makes that determination?
The court in this case made that determination after a lengthy trial.
Well, I'm talking about with the commission by itself. Do they make that determination?
There is a procedure within the...
I understood that two or three times Penn Central went there trying to work this out. Am I right?
No. Penn Central...
They didn't go there?
Well, they had applied to the commission for the right to knock down Grand Central Terminal and put up an office building. The question was whether or not that application was appropriate for the purpose of effectuating the chapter, the statute. And the Landmarks Commission properly determined that it would not be appropriate. Penn Central did not choose to litigate that issue in a court proceeding. Indeed, they have not chosen to litigate the question of whether Grand Central Terminal is a landmark. It must be assumed. With respect to the analogy to zoning, in zoning, it is reasonable to divide up area into geography, into geographical areas. That's the reasonableness of a zoning plan. But with a landmark regulation, the reasonableness depends upon the preservation purpose. And that purpose is only achieved by preserving the landmarks wherever they may be in the city of New York. And it is that distinction. It is a different type of land use regulation.
And you can do it at
any time. Excuse me?
The Landmark Commission can do this at any time it sees fit.
Well, no. There are procedures set up where they have to have a hearing. They
I
have to make
time-wise, they could do it on a building that was 80 years old.
Yes, that is correct. But the built-in safeguard is that if a owner of the subject property is unhappy with the designation, he can bring a special proceeding in the Supreme Court and challenge the designation on the basis of arbitrariness and capriciousness. One of the factors in considering whether there's been a deprivation of due process.
Now, I assume that's true as to all state commissions.
That is correct.
So it's nothing new.
It is, especially
for this commission.
Well, that's precisely our point, that this is a land use regulation that has the same effect as any other land use regulation.
What if in that proceeding the court decides that the commission was absolutely right, no one can dispute this as a historical landmark? Is that the end of it?
No, because all that says is that the designation is proper. Whether or not the designation makes the property economically unviable is the type of issue that was reviewed by all the state courts and this court. That's the due process question.
And what standard do they use?
whether or not the property as restricted is being precluded of all reasonable beneficial use. But I want to point out that...
Not of all economic use, but some profitable.
That's correct. But what they do determine is what this court has constantly reiterated, that when the police power is properly exercised, and by the way, there is no dispute that this is the proper subject for the exercise of the police power, that the highest and maximum use is not a necessary goal, that it's presumed that that goal can be withdrawn when you exercise the police power. That is a necessary byproduct.
Do they set a percentage of return on initial investment like
no, they haven't. They did not do that because in this particular case there was such a failure of proof, they didn't have to quantify it.
Now you say as a case comes to us, we must judge it on the basis that Grand Central and its present use is profitable.
Must be, and that, Your Honor, that is the essence of this case, and that the appellant has ignored the lengthy trial, and the two findings of the appellate courts.
Mr. Cornell?
Yes, sir.
Grand Central is still used by the railroads for passenger service.
That is correct.
Let's assume that the Interstate Commerce Commission allowed the station to be closed for rail service on the ground that not enough people used it for that purpose, and assume further that no other use of the building in its present condition is deemed feasible.
Right.
What would your position be with respect to that situation?
Penn Central would be entitled to relief because the property as restricted was not economically viable.
Is that clear from the New York
Yes,
law?
It is. Yes. And I again want to emphasize The attempt by the appellant to ignore the substantial factual data presented during the trial.
Is there a specific section of the New York law that deals with that situation?
In this particular case, it came under the guise of a challenge to the application as a deprivation of due process. To answer your question, it was framed in response to a due process issue raised in court. With respect to other challenges internally through the administrative process, we allow for an application for a certificate of appropriateness, that is, even to the extent of demolishing the landmark parcel if it is not economically viable.
But that isn't in the statute.
It is in the statute.
It is.
But Penn Central was a tax-exempt property, and the statute did not have this exception applicable to a tax-exempt property. So Penn Central sued in court, and they attempted to prove in court what they could not prove before the commission.
Well, in any event, similar.
It's the same test.
Similar to the question my brother Powell. If the company at any time in the future, next year or the year after that, any time it can prove that the situation has changed and that the property is no longer economically viable, it'll get released.
That's precisely the answer. Well, that is right.
What again is the definition of being economically viable?
It wasn't required to be quantified in this case, but it has been traditionally meant that on his investment, he would be able to earn approximately a 6%.
Like a public utilities.
Correct.
Okay.
But
well,
in this case.
Supposing that the New York Central Railroad is applying to the Railroad Rate Commission in New York for an intrastate fare change, and the commission decides that you can make 6% on which we consider a reasonable rate without a spur track of 3 miles, which you presently own. So we're just going to take that 3 mile spur track away from you. And you'll still make 6% on the total investment you have. Do you think you could do that?
No, because I don't see the strength of the public purpose in that particular case.
Well, supposing they want the spur track as a railroad museum to show how the 20th century used to look.
And, well, then again, the answer to Your Honor's question is that in your application, you are singling out that particular railroad and restricting its development of its property. The entire concept of this scheme is that we are not singling out Penn Central. We are treating it like every other landmark within the city of New York. We have designated over 500 properties. Indeed, before a designation is completed, that designation has to be approved by the City Planning Commission, which must determine whether it's consistent with the zoning plan and the master plan, and whether or not any urban renewal development might interfere.
Mr. Kerner, could I return for a moment to Justice Powell's question about economic viability of a demolition or something like that? As I understood the statute, the statutory test of whether to grant a certificate of appropriateness doesn't say anything at all about economic viability. Am I wrong on that?
There are two bases for certificate of appropriateness. With respect to Penn Central, because it was a tax-exempt property, you are correct that they could not have gotten a certificate of appropriateness administratively because the economic viability question is not allowed since they were tax-exempt. With respect to other commercial properties, a certificate of appropriateness can be granted.
On the ground of economic...
That is correct.
What section of the statute authorizes that?
207.6.0?
I don't see anything in there about economic viability.
Can I? I just want to use my time.
All right. But you do agree that with respect to the...
Section 207-8.0.
Oh, 8.0. But with respect to the Grand Central, economics are totally irrelevant.
No, because while he could not get administrative relief, we agree that if he had established his case in court that the property was not economically viable, he would have been entitled to judicial relief under the...
But not under subsection 6.
No, that is correct, under due process.
And the statute... under the Constitution. In other words, you're admitting that as applied in that situation, the statute would be unconstitutional.
If we had not had the added step that whatever deficiency was in the landmark law was corrected at trial,
Well, but the landmark law in it, as it reads, is unconstitutional if it doesn't allow for some kind of remedy when there's this kind of economic...
That is correct, but it's not the issue in this case, because Penn Central had the opportunity to establish under the very same test and failed.
Mr. Kerner, I'm a little confused about your references to tax exemption. What specifically is tax exempt here?
The railroad does not have to pay full city real estate taxes on the terminal. There is an exemption under the railroad law for that portion of the terminal that is used for railroad purposes, so that they only pay approximately one-third the assessed valuation.
Is the theory be that they're taxed in other ways, or?
It was intended to encourage them to keep up the railroad system.
Does it make any difference to the constitutional issues in this case whether they were totally tax exempt or paid the full tax that everyone else pays?
No.
So in this respect,
the tax exemption is really the same posture.
Same posture as St. John's Church.
That's correct. With the exception that here, though, you can equate their business with whether or not they can make a reasonable rate of return. You can determine. And one thing we've left out, my time is running out, but I want to emphasize one other factor that is quite important. We have concentrated on the restriction of Grand Central Terminal and whether that restriction imposes on them an extraordinary burden, not present when other land use regulation impacts on a parcel. What we have left out, and the appellant has not commented on, are the air rights. We have never contended that the transfer development rights were equal in value to what the person lost. But that isn't the test. The test is whether the transfer development rights constituted a valuable asset to the appellant that, when added to his return on the railroad, which he was unable to establish, whether that satisfied even the appellant's test of fairness. And I want to briefly mention the evidence that was upheld by the two appellate courts.
Mr. Kerner, before you do that, let me just understand your theory. If there's no taking here, you don't even have to give them the TDR.
That is correct.
Then why do we have to consider
it? Because the air rights are part of the comprehensive scheme and an attempt to at least recognize that we're going to try to do everything
you've been more generous than the Constitution compels you to
and
be.
We have,
why do we have to? Why is that of any relevance at all, what we have to decide?
Because Judge Pritel felt that the air rights were...
But nobody's defending his rationale.
No, to the extent... No. To the extent that he relied on the air rights, it was appropriate to consider the air rights in the context of the whole package to determine exactly whether we've been fair. And let me...
What difference does it make whether you've been fair? I don't understand your
because
argument.
Because the fairness concept advocated by the appellant goes to the concept of due process in determining value. You cannot set our plan contemplates giving the individual designee this.
But your legal position is you don't have to be fair.
No, that isn't our legal position.
Your position is, as I understand it, that there can be a taking sometimes under this.
That is correct, but there has not been in this particular case,
right.
And that the facts and circumstances of this particular case show there has not been. I'll only take one more minute. With respect to the air rights, the testimony at trial showed that the proposed builder, UPG, had offered Penn Central $3.8 million a year for the right to develop air rights over the Biltmore Hotel, an eligible receiving site under the transfer development rules. Penn Central's representative testified that $3.8 was insufficient because it wanted $5 million. It computed the $5 million as follows. It was guaranteed $3 million if it developed the air rights above the terminal. In addition, its profit from the Biltmore was $2 million. So to get the same deal that it would have had with respect to building over Grand Central Terminal, it concluded it had to receive $5 million. Well, I urge that this is not the issue before the court. The issue isn't whether or not Penn Central was entitled to the highest and best use, the $5 million. The issue is whether or not the $3.8 million return by using the Biltmore site, together with their failure to establish that the property as restricted cannot earn a reasonable rate of return, is so unfair as to really, in all effect, totally emasculate the land use regulation that's now under attack. Because in a city like New York, it is unusual for all of the landmarks to be clustered in historic districts. And for the preservation purpose to be accomplished, it is necessary that the Landmarks Commission be able to act wherever it finds a building of a historical and architectural significance. The total plan here is a reasonable one. It's a different type of land use regulation. But all of the courts have applied the traditional rules and have properly concluded that this regulation should be sustained.
Mr. Kern, let me just ask one more question. I know you're concerned about your time, but if the transfer rights are of equal value or substantially equal value, couldn't we hold that there was a taking and then on retrial they'd find that there was just compensation?
No.
You'd go ahead with your program without any interference?
No, because I don't think the transfer rights were of the equivalent value.
Oh, you concede they were not.
It was not litigated in court. All that was litigated
for purposes of our decision, we should assume they're not.
That's correct.
Mr. Wald.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the United States has a vital interest in these proceedings today. Congress and the executive have declared in many statutes that it's a national policy that, quote, historical and cultural foundations of the nation should be preserved as a living part of our community life and development in order to give our people a, quote, sense of orientation. Now, the federal government is deeply involved in historical preservation in many ways, and I will allude to them only briefly. Number one, it designates and preserves historic landmarks on its own public lands. Two, it sometimes utilizes the power of eminent domain to acquire sites of national historic significance. Number three, since 1966, it maintains a national registry of historic buildings which have local, state, city, and national significance and now contains 15,000 such buildings. Fourth, it provides financial aid to states and cities so that they can survey their historic preservation problems, formulate plans, and embark on preservation projects to preserve their treasures. And fifth, all federal agencies, pursuant to the 1966 Act and to an executive order, who license projects or spend money on projects in any state, must take account of the need to preserve historic sites which are registered or which are eligible for registration. Finally, there are several very specific enactments, including the National Environmental Protection Act, which requires NEPA impact statements to assess the impact of historic sites that might be affected by proposed projects.
Ms. Wald, can I just interrupt because it goes to what you're reciting now. Has the United States ever imposed a regulation on private use of private property for historic purposes without compensating the owner?
I do not believe it has directly done so.
So however, it's never done anything comparable to what we have before us?
Not to my knowledge, but may I add that it does provide subsidization to local groups to embark upon some of their projects pursuant to laws like the New York City Landmark Law, which use a regulatory framework for
preservation.
But is it
fair to say that the federal policy has always been that where there's a public benefit, the public shall pay?
I believe that that's an overstatement for the following reasons. Naturally, the federal government has relied primarily upon state and local governments and their police power and their particular historic preservation laws to bring about the preservation of buildings except where those buildings are on public lands. However, we do have several instances, not for historic preservation, but for other uses, which raise the similar question whether the federal government, through its regulatory powers, does in fact impose restrictions upon land use which it does not compensate for by eminent domain. In the area of historic preservation, to my knowledge, you are correct, Justice Stevens, that we don't do it directly.
Suppose a farmer up near Manassas is suddenly informed that the records now discover that an important part of the Battle of Manassas was fought on his farm. And therefore, they'll let him graze his cows and raise some grain, but that he can't sell it. It's just going to be preserved for the benefit of the whole people. Do you mean to suggest that they don't have to pay him the going rate per acre for that farm?
If we are referring now, as I believe you are, to the national government taking such action, then right now the national government would either have to do it through eminent domain or through a state or local government which had jurisdiction. We don't have any statutes on the books, to my knowledge, which allow us to have a national historic preservation regulatory framework such as the states and cities. That is not to say, Your Honor, and certainly we don't have the question before us today, that it wouldn't be possible for Congress to enact such.
Well, yeah, the Chief Justice's question was a constitutional question, and that's because that's what we have in this case, not whether or not you happen to have, at the moment, a federal statute.
It's always very hazardous to pass on constitutional questions ahead of time.
Well, what we have to do in this case.
You are passing on a statute, of course, that is on the books for New York City. If the federal government, pursuant to a federal jurisdiction, passed such a statute, I believe that, if properly written, it would be constitutional.
Without compensation?
Without compensation in the sense that it would be subject to the same tests which we suggest constitutionally apply to the state and local government. If it became so onerous to the landholder, if he could not take any beneficial uses out of his property,
then it would become a taking,
and it would be unconstitutional.
The beneficial use that my farmer friend up at Manassas has in mind is to leave it to his children or to sell it, as the case may be. And he can get $1,500 an acre for it in some places now. Are you suggesting the United States government or any government could take that property without paying him the going rate?
I'm not suggesting they could take it, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm suggesting that a valid historical landmark statute could allow them to restrict its usage so that a particular historic framework or particular historic use would not be violated.
Now, if he had an offer to sell it to a supermarket, landmark supermarket, would that be the price? The Grand Central Supermarket. Would that be the price he'd have to be paid?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question, Mr. Justice Marshall.
I just put one little point into the Chief Justice's book. Now we've got cattle and all there. The Grand Central Supermarket has come to them, and they want to build a huge land mall there, and they will give him $2,500 an acre. Is that the price?
Is that the price you suggest that the government would have
yes,
to pay?
Yes.
I believe that the federal government could indeed enact a statute which would not require them to pay the price you suggest, the going rate on the market for the land, simply because they had restricted its uses so as to prevent him from selling it to the supermarket.
Let me get back to the hypothetical that I gave Mr. Cribben and see what your answer is. The National Presbyterian Church was surely an historic place on Connecticut Avenue. Out in front of the building was the statue of John Witherspoon, one of the signers of the Declaration, I think. They contracted to sell it for $3 or $4 million. And suppose after they contracted to sell it in order to build a new church further out, and had this $3 or $4 million contract, the District of Columbia had said, no, that's going to be a landmark. You can't sell it. Now you've got the going market value fixed by a contract, an arm's length contract with the National Broadcasters Association, put the building up there. Do you suggest the District of Columbia, under any statute, could have taken that property without paying them for it?
I do suggest that the District of Columbia could have passed a regulation which required, after designation, through a reasonable mechanism of that church as a historical site, that indeed either that site must be maintained, the church must be maintained, or if it were sold, the successor must maintain it in the church form. And I believe that a somewhat similar case, the Benenson case here, where indeed the district...
Well, you wouldn't say that if it were sold for $10 or whatever the buyer would pay, and then he just closed down the church. You couldn't make him operate the church.
No,
you
certainly
wouldn't suggest that, would you?
No, I wouldn't suggest that. No, I would not.
And the city here would indicate that if they ceased operating as a church, it would no longer be appropriate to restrict the use
without compensation.
I would suggest that since the property was originally, its original use, its present use at the time it was designated, was as a church, that indeed nobody can be made, obviously, to operate a church if they don't want to. But I think what can be done is to restrict other uses of the property.
Well, in the Grand Central case, are you differing with your colleague that if the Penn Central just shut the terminal down, that it would still be required to leave the building as it is?
I believe the statute is valid, and under the statute, if it wished to shut down the station, to cease operating, to demolish the...
They just cease operating it, and then they go in before the commission and say, we're not making a nickel on this unless we can do something with it. We can't even pay our taxes on it, reduced as they are.
I believe that...
I thought your colleague indicated that then they could tear it down. Or at least if they were going to have to leave it standing, they had to be paid for it.
Right.
I believe that the courts, although it isn't in the statute in Grand Central's case, but I believe that the courts, the New York courts in that situation, if they didn't want to operate it at all, would indeed permit them to cease operating it. But I'm not sure that it would permit them to go ahead and make another use of the property.
Well, the point is, event hypothesized by my brother White, would the Constitution then require that compensation be paid?
I do not believe that the Constitution would require that compensation be paid simply because they decided they didn't want to operate it anymore as a railroad station. I believe that they would be before a taking and compensation would be required. Under existing law, they would be required to find some beneficial use, to attempt to find some beneficial use that didn't violate the nature of the preservation law. And I believe, in fact, that's what most of the cases this Court has held in the past would suggest. For instance, in the Goldblatt case, the case said candidly the ordinance completely prohibited the use, the excavation pit use to which the property had been put before. That was completely ruled out, yet the Court held that was not a taking because the plaintiff might well find some other uses for the property or there hadn't been any showing that he couldn't. There have been cases in which the South Terminal case in Boston, where the EPA simply said in its regulations and its transportation plan, you may not use X percentage of parking spaces, because if you do, it will affect the air, Clean Air Act. And the court there held, the First Circuit, that was not a taking, because even though you could not use those spaces for parking spaces for which they had originally been intended, you had to look around and find some other uses, less valuable uses.
Is your test then, just applying it to the historic landmark area, if the landmark designation causes the property owner to actually lose money on the property, then it's a taking. If he can still make a reasonable return, it's not a taking. Is that your test?
That's pretty much the test. I think it's a test of the past cases here. I think as long as there is a profitable use to the property, there hasn't been a taking, and there have been innumerable cases.
And is it just one penny a profit or a reasonable return?
Certainly the cases do not tell us in the past. They leave the formula. In fact, I think
we have to decide.
No set formula as a reasonable return or a beneficial use.
So you just say just a marginal profit wouldn't be enough. It has to be a reasonable return.
I'd say a reasonable return is a beneficial use.
And reasonable return, how does one measure that? If it's a lot less than could be obtained by putting it to some other use, is it still reasonable?
I believe so, and I believe that's exactly what all of the cases have said. We do not take the test of the most profitable use. Most recently and most...
But you don't take the test of the least profitable use either.
It would be zero.
I certainly believe the Constitution would require the owner, if he couldn't use it for a particular purpose, to be able to go out and find the most profitable use consistent with the point of the regulation, namely the preservation of the landmark.
You mean you're going to make him do something with it?
No, we're going to permit him to do something with it.
What if he just wants to board it up?
If he wants to board it up and that does not in some way infringe upon the historical preservation aspect of the property, then he could do that. If the historical preservation simply said this is a beautiful church to look at from the outside, and we don't care what happens, whether anybody goes in it or anything else, then he can just leave it stand there if he wants to. On the other hand, if he wants to continue to run it as a church,
Who should pay the $10,000 a year insurance premiums on it and public liability in the meantime?
Well, the church may be the wrong example, but in essence, the owner continues with all of both the liabilities and the profits of ownership. But any owner has certain options about how to use his property.
What profit have you got on a boarded-up building?
If you boarded it up by your own choice, then you...
No, boarded it up because the government, from your point of view, would not let him sell it, not let them sell it.
In most of these cases, the sale, and indeed in the case instance here in the New York law, they do not forbid the sale per se. They only forbid the sale for a use which is restricted. So, indeed, many of the cases in which the courts have held there is no taking, that a reasonable regulatory use, they point out that it leaves the option with the owner as to whether or not he wants to sell or lease it or use it for other purposes. All of these cases, if I may finish the one sentence, all of the land use cases have pointed out that it is almost inevitable, starting with Justice Holmes back in the Cole case, that when the government pursues a police power for a legitimate end, it will likely end up with a diminution of value of land and the restriction of use. And unless that becomes so onerous as to move over into a taking, and where that line is drawn, the courts have over the years said, is very difficult, that it is a reasonable use of the police power. And I think the rule, which appellant would suggest that any time there is a loss in value of property due to a reasonably valid regulation, use of the police power, that the owner must be compensated, is indeed a radical revolutionary rule which just simply has no foundation in the past cases of the police power or indeed in the taken cases themselves. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have anything further, Mr. Goodman?
If I may briefly, Mr. Chief Justice, I should like to answer Mr. Justice Marshall's inquiry and make clear that Penn Central did make an effort with the Landmarks Commission to obtain a certificate of appropriateness and no exterior effect. And in the Landmarks Commission, there was never any attention paid to dollars. That was strictly an aesthetic determination. The only time economic loss came into the picture was when the case went into court. And then, instead of inquiring as to whether there was a taking and making a determination which is not terribly complex in this case as to the value of what was taken, the courts went off on this economic inquiry and a reasonable return, which, as you read the Court of Appeals opinion, we were bound to lose. There was no way to win under the way the Court of Appeals analyzed this economic problem.
Now, Mr. Griffin, what if in passing this ordinance or whatever, was it an ordinance? What was it?
This Landmarks law is an ordinance.
What if they had done their homework before they passed the ordinance and said the following landmarks are hereby designated right in the ordinance, and they did 30 of them or 40, and so that you weren't singled out at all? It's just that they thought they had spotted all the landmarks in town.
If the economic impact on us was the same ultimately as it is here, the fact that they were designated in the law rather than designated by the commission would be immaterial.
But you wouldn't be singled out. So
well, singled out. Certainly, we're singled out.
At least
much
you'd be
more
one of 30.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
At least you'd be one of 30.
Yes, but you understand that they don't operate the same way. Among these 30 are the Statue of Liberty, and the Landmarks Law doesn't operate on it with nearly the impact it operates on us. Another one is a tree in Brooklyn. It's the way it operates to take property that we complain of here.
Well, I think. I've heard this argument. It's narrowed the issue. As I understand your opponent, he concedes that there might be occasions and circumstances under which the operation of this ordinance did operate so as to be a taking in the constitutional sense. And you concede, with respect to the Statue of Liberty or the tree in Brooklyn, that there might be occasions when it didn't so operate. And the question then is, does it in this particular case
operate here?
Yeah.
And
do you agree that we judge the case on the assumption
the station is a sustainable economic operation?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the only
basis... but did you disprove it? Or I thought there were the findings that it was, as they say, economically viable.
I say the Court of Appeals finding to that effect is totally erroneous, because it is based on this concept that we need only earn a return on the privately contributed ingredient.
Let's assume for the moment that destroys the entire finding. Let's assume for the moment that we accept it, that it's economically viable, but nevertheless, it's perfectly obvious you could make more if you build a big building on it.
I still say, even if you accept it, the decision is wrong and we are entitled to compensation. I don't think the fact that what we have left over is atonement for what has been taken from us.
In your brief at page 17, you cite this court's opinion in Fuller, where you say that the government in a condemnation case can't exclude from consideration of the jury the value that may be added by the fact that the government built a post office near the site 80 years ago. Is that substantially your argument
here? I think it is. I think that's a very important part of our argument. And I think that this highest and best use is something that has to be looked at very carefully, and I would ask the Court to look at the Cosby decision here in 328, which is cited, which illustrates a number of things. In the first place, property was not taken by the government, yet there was a loss to the property owner, and he was compensated for. Second, his entire property wasn't taken. He was compensated because he was no longer able to operate a chicken farm, and it was clear that he could have operated a vegetable patch. The Court noted that. But the compensation was because he was prevented from doing that. The Court also said that an expected use of a property is properly to be taken into account in making a valuation for taking purposes.
The expected use, is that what you said?
That's what it said, an expected use.
How is that different from the highest and best potential use?
I'm not sure how it is different. I think it makes more sense because an expected use is clearly an element of value. That's why people buy it, for what they expect to do. I think the highest and beneficial use is a term that has really outlived its usefulness, if it ever had any. Because I think the cases stand for the proposition that you get compensation for what has been taken, whatever the value.
Is that term obsolete when a church could show that it has a contract to sell the church and the site for $4.5 million? Doesn't that give some evidence of the highest and best use?
I would put it under terms of expected use. It makes him
the highest and best use might be to sell it as a slaughterhouse for $8,000, which the zoning would
prohibit, but for a legitimate use.
The highest and best use always is restrained by the permissible use.
As the Solicitor General recognizes, a statute such as this landmarks law creates unusual opportunities for arbitrary action. And the remedy is not in judicial review of the landmark designation. Those who own property that's coveted for public use are rarely, if ever, going to be a majority at the polls or in lawmaking bodies. And the only effective discipline on government acquisition of private resources is that provided by the pocketbook. Only if the elected representatives and their designees are required to make a cost-benefit analysis and pay through the taxes what they are going to acquire from private people for public use, is there any protection for private property against ever-expanding government acquisition of private resources?
Yet what if you have a regulation put down by OSHA that puts down a number of safety standards and the owner says, I simply can't run the business with all these safety standards? Does that mean that he has a claim of taking, or is that simply a question of a regulation that forces an individual out of business?
Well,
like
I think it
Brandeis's dissent in May. Huh?
It may be. If the representatives have decided that those OSHA requirements are necessary in the to do away with harm, that may be a price that the individual owner has to pay. But I suggest a difference between that when the government goes out in a resource acquisition capacity, as it is doing here, as it did in the case of the Gettysburg war battlefield many years ago, and where the government did pay eminent domain for it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Of course, in the Cosby case, the airspace above a minimum safe altitude wasn't deemed compensable, was it?
Above, yes, that's right, Your Honor. It was the interference with the use.
Right. Yes.
And as I said, they could take into account an expected use, and that's precisely what we're doing here, a recognizable expected use of a small building in the middle of Manhattan.
It was impact on the use of the land below, that, on the surface.
Yes, but I don't know that that would distinguish it. This is a recognized property use. You have to begin from the bottom and go up.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.